policy base to a centrist one. Specifically on the economy, he has embraced growth as the lever of prosperity, very much embracing trickle down, or as they would call it, float up. So the tide will rise and all the boats will float up with it. He has embraced a sort of austerity that implies that there will be either cuts or maintained reduction to investment in public services. And he has broadly and actually resoundingly rejected the logic, and I quote, the logic of tax and spend. And so in that sense, he is very much a politician that has embraced the sort of conventional, mainstream, centrist capitalist wisdom on the economy, which is problematic in a country that is now suffering the consequences of 14 years of austerity. Public infrastructure is on its knees, schooling, housing, the National Health Service, public services for youth, for maternal services, families has all been decimated. And so it's a curious position on which to stand in a position of power where the problems that have been presented or the problems that you're going to inherit all need some sort of serious spending. So that's where he is domestically. So in terms of foreign policy, they have embraced something called progressive realism. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has been coining and repeating this concept of progressive realism, which he states or he explains as treating the world or finding the world as it is, so therefore being realistic about what can be achieved. This is something that is also going to be a difficult balance if your approach to foreign policy is it is what it is and there's not much we can do, then there are a lot of domestic pressures vis-a-vis Gaza that have already cost the Labour Party votes that they're going to have to negotiate or navigate very carefully in the next few months.
Nisreen Malik, you wrote of Rishi Sunak, the previous prime minister, who called for the snap election. You write, quote, Sunak could not clean up the wreckage because he was the wreckage. Why do you think this election even took place?
I think Rishi Sunak was trying to reduce the damage. It was clear that the Tory party was finished. And the question was, finished how badly? How many seats were they going to lose? Rishi Sunak had received some good news about inflation and decided that was maybe the moment to try and capitalize on that good news and maybe not lose as many seats as they did. There was never going to be a good time to call the election. Maybe in 6 months' time, they would have lost more seats, but essentially the Tory parties in the hinterland of power for the next 5-10 years, arguably at least. So it was a bad time. He thought it was the best time, but there wouldn't have been a good time anyway.
And finally, as you speak to us from Nairobi, Kenya, from your perch there, though you've been writing extensively for The Guardian about the UK elections, any final thoughts on what's taken place in Kenya with more than 40 people killed in these protests calling for the president to resign after he tried to push through this very unpopular tax bill, a real youth uprising?
It has been a really remarkable time in Kenya. It's taken everyone by surprise. Protests against the government had a very different profile in the past. They had a very different class profile. They had a very different tribal profile. And there was a lot of astroturfing or manipulation of protesters based on the agendas of politicians who wanted to get in power. This is very much, or was very much, an organic, spontaneous movement, cross-class, cross-demographic, and something that really rose up from the belly of the kind of Kenyan state and the Kenyan people. The government reacted really unwisely and didn't quite assess correctly the scale of the anger and responded with violence, which only triggered people further. And then something remarkable happened, which sort of rarely happens in these sorts of scenarios, which is the president conceded and said the word "I concede," and withdrew the tax bill that the people were protesting against. But That was not enough to diffuse anger because things had sort of gone a bit too far by then, and too many people had been killed, and too much violence and provocation on the part of the authorities had taken place. And so there is still a lot of anger. There are still protests here and there, and there is still a sort of underground security operation happening against members of those protest movements and their leaders. So it's a confrontation that has broken or cracked open something quite new in Kenya, and it's not over yet.
Nisrin Malakwana, thank you for being with us, author and columnist for The Guardian. We'll link to your articles on the UK elections, speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya. Next up, France, the upset victory over the right by the left. We'll go to Paris, and then we'll look at the elections in Iran. Stay with us. I am tired. Are you with me? By Nadine Shah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to France, where a newly formed leftist coalition dealt a surprising blow to the far right and French President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party in Sunday's final round of a heated snap parliamentary election. The leftist coalition, the New Popular France, won the most seats in the French parliament as a political alliance between center-left and more progressive parties came together to defeat Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party after the far right held a significant lead in elections first round last week and scored major advances in recent European Parliament elections. Supporters of the leftist New Popular Front took to the streets to celebrate as results were announced Sunday. No party has secured an absolute majority in France's National Assembly, with the New Popular Front winning 182 seats, short of the 289 seats required for an absolute majority to form a new government. Prime Minister Macron stunned France by dissolving National Assembly and calling snap elections in the hopes French voters would keep his centrist coalition in power. Following their defeat, Macron's prime minister, Gabriel Attal, offered to resign. But Macron today asked him to stay on temporarily to, quote, ensure the stability of the country, end quote. The pair met at the presidential palace earlier today, along with Macron's top political allies. The New Popular Front has vowed to raise the minimum wage, to cap the price of essential foods and utilities, and to throw out Macron's hugely unpopular pension reform, which raised the retirement age. The group says it'll reimpose taxes on the wealthiest and corporations. The New Popular Front also says it'll recognize Palestinian statehood after Macron's government earlier this year refused to do so. The head of the Progressive France Unbowed party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, spoke following his coalition's victory Sunday.
Le président a le pouvoir.
The president has the power. The president has the duty to call on the New Popular Front to govern. It is ready. The New Popular Front will respect the mandate according to the vote cast for its candidates. Our given word will be respected. The New Popular Front will apply its manifesto, all its manifesto and nothing but its manifesto.
Far-right leader Marine Le Pen, whose party had steadily risen in popularity across France, backing anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist, anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic policies, slammed the results of the election.
We're losing one more year of unregulated immigration, one more year of losing purchasing power, one more year of a blowing up of insecurity in our country.
comes just a few weeks before Paris hosts the Olympics. For more, we go to Paris, where we're joined by two guests. Marjane Satrapi is a French-Iranian filmmaker off the graphic novel Persepolis. Her recent book, Woman, Life, Freedom, she designed a 30-foot-long tapestry commissioned to mark the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. We're also joined by Rekhaya Diallo, French journalist, writer, and filmmaker. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Rekhaya, let's begin with you. Your assessment of what took place, this upset victory where the left came in first, the centrist, Macron, came in second, and the far right third.
Collective effort of people from the civil society who managed to make sure to put the far right away from the power, because the threat was very concrete, and many people actually realized how dangerous the fact that the far right could be in position of power could be for France, not only for people who are, you know, minorities, immigrants, women, LGBTQIA, but also for the institutions, since the far right program intended to challenge the Constitution and to lower the power of the Supreme Courts.
And talk more about why Macron did this. I mean, he and the significance of him not accepting the resignation of the prime minister today. Will he remain president of France?
I think it did this. It was a gamble because he didn't win the European election, and he thought that it was a way for him to reshuffle the power. Actually, many people still struggle to understand why he made that choice, because it was very dangerous. It was at a moment when the far right, the National Rally, was gaining more and more power. So it's still a mystery to me because it was such an indispensable move. And today his decision to maintain Gabriel Attal is because we know that nobody really won the election. The parliament is kind of in between several different forces that none of them has an absolute majority. So I think that he hopes that he will be able to build a coalition around the center, so the center right and the center left, and so that would make him able to keep Gabriel Attal the prime minister in power, and not to lose the capacity of be the one forming the government.
I wanted to bring Marjane Satrapi into this conversation, French-Iranian filmmaker and author. Can you talk about what's going on in the streets right now? Were people themselves as surprised as the media was around the world at what took place? And what does this mean? Is this meaning a hung parliament? What power will Marine Le Pen's party have in all of this? You came to Paris, what, some 30 years ago, and we're taking on Jean-Marie Le Pen, her father.
Yes, hello. First of all, I think that this election is actually the whole country of France has won. France has succeeded. The value that are defended in France, the value or the value of the human rights, or the value of, you know, actually accepting people, having them, giving them shelter. So this France is very contradictory with the France of Marine Le Pen. Then is about 30% of the French population that actually would vote for the extreme right, and that is not something new. We have that since many years. They made a big deal, you know, in the European election, which is bizarre because the people of the extreme right that are in the European Parliament, they don't do nothing. They're actually, most of the time, they're absent. People, they actually voted for them, but then, you know, we always have this idea that we really have to defend the republic, and the extreme right is against the republic. I heard people saying, oh, we never tried, you know, the extreme right, so let's see what it gives. We actually have tried the extreme right. It's called the regime de Vichy. It's called what has happened on the Second World War, where they were extremely active, more than what the German, they asked them, you know, in the execution of the Jews and the communists, and, you know, they collaborated. So yes, we have that. And I think the danger of the extreme right in the whole world today is equal. I mean, people, they don't have the excuse of not knowing what the extreme right gives. Nobody has the excuse of this lack of knowledge. We all know what happened in the Second World War. We know that that was the extreme right, and we know what is the result of the extreme right. So no, anywhere in the world, in the democratic world, that is a vote for that is actually a vote for dictatorship. And French people, basically, most of them, they didn't want. Now the situation is somehow complex. But you talk a lot about Jean-Luc Mélenchon. I don't think that he's a representative of this united left, because unlike what is said, he's not a progressive leftist. He's a radical leftist. I think he's anti-Semite. His relationship with Hamas is quiet. We don't know what it is. His relation with Putin is uncertain. He has been in awe in front of all the dictators of South American. You know, he was in love with Chavez. He loves all these dictators. I think this coalition, you have four parties. One of them is the party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, where the big heads of actually this party, they have left it because they couldn't stand him anymore. People like Clémentine Aubrin or Ruffin or all this big power they have left. You have the communists, you have the socialists, you have the ecologists. So you have this coalition. But the most important, that was a slap in the face of the extreme right. But also during this 1 week, I think people in the television and in the interviews, they saw the candidate of the extreme right. And, you know, it's a joke as a candidate. None of them, they have a program. I mean, it's always easy to be against. It's always very easy to be in opposition. But once it comes to govern the country, you have to have some knowledge. You have to have an economical program. You know, just saying, oh, the immigrant people, they do this and that, and they come. You know, the immigrant people also work. I mean, I work in France. Each film that I made in France, I don't know, hundreds of French people work. We bring money, we pay our taxes. We are part of this society. So, and French people, they celebrated that. So, yeah, it's the victory of France.
I want to ask Rokhaya Diallo if you share that assessment of Mélenchon. Certainly Jeremy Corbyn, who we just spoke to, who won back his seat as a member of parliament in Britain as a friend of Mélenchon, did not feel that way. Your assessment and where this all goes?
So I think, first of all, the issue is not about Jean-Luc Mélenchon. It's about the left which managed to build a coalition. I don't agree with the fact of classifying the France Humboldt, the party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, as a radical left party, since the Supreme Court of France, Le Conseil d'État, has classified the parties. And the only party that is classified as being extreme is the far-right National Rally. So all of the left parties as labeled as being from the left. And the other thing, to me, which is important, is that I think it's important to temper the joy of the fact that the National Rally, the far right, didn't win, because even if they didn't make it to have the absolute majority, they had opened the floodgates of racism. During the campaign, we've seen many people being abused, being assaulted, being insulted because they were LGBTQIA, because they were minorities, because they were foreigners. They have been physically and verbally insulted, even assaulted, even people who are very, you know, famous and visible journalists. So I think that we need to address what was at the heart of the campaign of the far right, which is racism. So, of course, there is an issue of anti-Semitism that needs to be addressed on the left, and not only, according to me, in the party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon. I think this is an issue, but I think that they have been demonized because of their pro-Palestinian stance and because they are the only party to actually address Islamophobia. And I think that the left in France needs to address Islamophobia, because the anti-Muslim sentiment is very, very widespread, and it's the reason why the National Rally has been normalized, because the Islamophobia is so normalized now today in France that it's easy for the National Rally just to appear to be respectable. So I think that the next step for the left will be to be explicit on how they want to address racism and actually systemic racism, because not only the France unbowed has been demonized, but also many anti-racism activists, and especially those who were Muslim, have been demonized and seen as being, you know, against the so-called universalist ideology supposed to be the prevailing ideology in France, and to me it's a myth. So I think that Jean-Luc Mélenchon is an issue to the left because he's still very authoritarian. He's when there was a candidate that was convicted for assaulting his wife, Jean-Luc Mélenchon supported him, and that was an issue to me as a feminist. And I think that he needs to be clear when someone is problematic in the party, that that person should be evicted for good. And I think that anti-Semitism is core to the far right. That's the program of the far right. It was the National Rally was founded by former Waffen-SS, by people who were Nazis, who were Holocaust deniers, and who were also involved in the French colonization of Algeria. So, you know, hearing only about the anti-Semitism on the left to me is problematic, since we are still today facing the danger of the far right, about to take over the power. And that's the issue for me.
Rokhaya Diallo, I want to thank you for being with us, French journalist, writer and filmmaker, speaking to us from Paris. Marjan Satrapi, French-Iranian filmmaker, I'd like to ask you to stay with us as we move next to Tehran to talk about an update on the Iranian elections. Stay with us.
Dure, dure, pushte kuha, ye sabure, pushte dashta, ye talai. پشت صحرا های خالی خونه ماست اون بر آب اون بر موجای بیتا پشت جنگل ها
خونه ما مرجان فرساد. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Iran, where voters elected Masoud Pezeshkian as the new president Saturday, defeating the hardliner Saeed Jalili. Pezeshkian is a heart surgeon who'd served as health minister under the reformist President Mohammad Khatami. He ran as a reformist candidate, criticized Iran's mandatory hijab law for women, has promised to disband Iran's so-called morality police. Saturday's election was held 6 weeks after the Iranian president Ibrahim Raisi and foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian died in a helicopter crash in May, along with several other officials and crew. Raisi was elected in 2021 in a vote that saw the lowest percentage turnout in the Islamic Republic's history after major opposition candidates were disqualified from taking part. For more, we continue with Marjan Satrapi, French-Iranian filmmaker, author of Woman, Life, Freedom. And in Tehran, we're joined by Reza Seya, freelance journalist, correspondent for France 24, Al Jazeera, and CNN. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Reza Seya, talk about who the new president is.
Well, I think first and foremost, even though he tried to shake off the reformist label during his campaign, he is clearly supported by Iran's reformist factions and its leaders, Mohammad Khatami, the former president, the former foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. They played a key role in his campaign. And this is a faction that wants better relations with the West, that's more moderate, that takes a more moderate tone with Washington. They prefer not to chant the death to America, death to Israel. Pezeshkian was a relatively low-profile candidate, a doctor, a heart surgeon who served in the Iran-Iraq war as a doctor. He's an Azeri Kurd from Iran's western Azerbaijan province. It's very likely he got a lot of support from the Kurdish minority and other minority groups. In his campaign, he promised more liberties, social freedom, something that many Iranians want. Although he made these promises in very vague terms, he also made statements about Iran's mandatory hijab law. He spoke directly to Iranian women, said they've been treated unfairly in the streets, seemingly referring to the crackdown after Mahsa Amini's death, saying that they've been unfairly treated. He suggested that the enforcement of the hijab law may be eased, but again, he spoke in very vague terms. He pledged to get Western sanctions removed. And all of these are reformist talking points that draw a lot of criticism from Iran's conservatives and hardliners. And seemingly during his campaign, in an effort to ease those criticisms, he repeatedly said that he's loyal to the supreme leader, loyal to the revolution, and that he's not going to be a disruptive force to the establishment.
Marjan Satrapi, you wrote the book Woman, Life, Freedom. That was the mantra of the pro-democracy movement in Iran. Your assessment of what's just taken place?
Listen, I think elections in Iran are a farce. Any candidate who has the possibility of standing is already chosen by the Supreme Guide, the Council of the Guardians, and the Guardian of the Revolution. That said, I mean, once you have passed this exam, basically you are one of them, and the real power is in the hand of the Supreme Guard and the Guardian of the Revolution. So the president does not change a lot. As soon as this regime knows that it is a dangerous situation, that the society is going to explode, it uses the reformer as a safety valve. They have done that with Khatami, they have done that in Rouhani, and during Khatami and during Rouhani, lots of people, they have been killed. I mean, you know, lots of them, they have been gone to jail. So we should not think that they're real reformists. The official figure, they say that it's 40% of the Iranian they have voted. But that is the official figure. When you look at the images that come from Iran, you see that all the polling stations, they're completely empty. So this 40% is already low, but my guess is much lower. But for me, all of that is done, as usual, to buy time. All the elected representatives of this country have their hand in the blood of the Iranian people, more or less, but they have their blood at the hand. Iranian young people, women from all walks of life, they express their desire for a true secular democracy. And this regime will never change. They will cut off heads, as we say in Persian, they will cut off heads with cotton wool or with laser blade, but they will cut off heads no matter. The most important thing for me now is that the democracies do not resume their discussion with this regime, which arrests, tortures, and rapes anyone who expresses their disagreement. This is a fact. If all the day that all the political prisoners are released, the day that our women, they're no longer killed or jailed for refusing to wear the veil, the day that we will see Narges Mohammadi or Tumay Salehi back in the street, the day that we will have a free press, then okay, let's talk about the reformists. Until now, they're just dogs of this regime.
Let me ask Reza Saya, final question. We just have 30 seconds, and that is, do you expect Iran's relations with the U.S. might change under Pezeshkian, and particularly the issue of nuclear weapons?
Well, that's the big question. How will things change? It's hard to say. The likelihood is that things are not going to change significantly, certainly immediately. Pezeshkian faces a conservative-dominated government. You know, that's a challenge of entrenched power structures that call the shots in foreign policy, including the supreme leader. These power structures call the shots when it comes to Iran's foreign policy, the nuclear issue, its backing of regional militias. But I think certainly it's likely that the tone of the government is going to change.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Reza Saya. I want to thank you for being with us, independent journalist in Tehran and Marjan Satrapi, French-Iranian filmmaker. This is Democracy Now!
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.